And welcome back this hour. Jim Steinmeier with us as we talk about his work, Who Was Dracula? We're going to take some phone calls, talk a little bit about magic as well, right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, Jim Steinmeier with us. Jim, just to chat with you a little bit about magic. We did that when you were back with me back a couple of years ago. Did you develop tricks? Did you create new tricks? How did you work with magicians?
Well, I worked as a designer with magicians and working on new material for them for their acts. And I've had the opportunity to work with a number of really great magicians over the years. Each of them, you know, have their strength. It's kind of like working with a singer, you know, writing songs for a singer.
Yeah.
In that each one kind of has a certain way of performing, and you try to get something that works in their show and works with all the other material in their show, and also shows off their abilities as well as a performer, whether it's sleight of hand. Whether it's you know, their personality, you try and tune the material to them. So I started working with Doug Henning years ago, and did some work with David Copperfield, Siegfried and Roy, Harry Blackstone. Boy, there are a bunch of performers over the years.
Now, when you're developing magic tricks for them and with them, do you have to be very good at, let's say, architecture or geometry? I mean, how do you develop these tricks?
Well, you're getting dangerously close to secrets there, but I'll tell you. No, that's all right. No, you know what? It's really funny. It's a little bit of everything. It's there's certainly math, and I sometimes shake my head over how much math I'll be doing or how much geometry, exactly as you said, really planning. You know, you have to kind of plan what the audience can see, and so you end up drawing. In the theater, they call them sightline studies, which means that you know exactly where the audience is going to be, and you're drawing the lines that they're going to be looking at. Very often, we use sightline studies to examine kind of how a prop has to be designed to fool somebody. And then we very often go to models. You know, we'll do little cardboard models and sometimes full-size models. We just completed an illusion a couple of years ago that took two full mock-ups before we actually started building it. That's something. That means we were working really hard on that one.
But that's right.
You don't want to do that all the time.
I mean, is there a lot of trial and error?
There is trial and error in it, yeah. As you get better at it, of course, there's, you know, as you do it longer, as I do it longer, certainly there's less trial and error in it. That's the good news about it. But every once in a while, you come up with something that you just hit a wall and you have to keep going.
How in the heck do you saw a person in half?
Boy, you know, it's funny. It's funny you mentioned that. That started happening in 1921, and it isn't that old a trick in the vaudeville age. And it just took off like a house of fire. It was a big, popular feature. You know, we talk about, like, you know, when we're talking about the Twilight books and things like that. Sawing a woman in half was a big hit, just like a big popular song.
Huge.
For about 5 years. And it inspired so many wonderful ideas, so many incredible ideas. That were all little variations on that. Everybody had a little different way of doing it, and some of the most ingenious secrets in magic have been turned towards that trick in a new way to accomplish it.
Did anybody ever get sawed in half by mistake?
Sawed in half. There have been horrible accidents.
Really?
Well, there have been horrible accidents because you're carrying a saw, or you have a power saw on stage, or because there are dangerous things involved in this. It's kind of like a juggler, you know, juggling chainsaws. You know, the fact that you have chainsaws and that you're turning them on is part of the problem. Whether someone got sawed in half during the show, I think that I have never heard that an audience has actually been watching it. But there have been terrible accidents because of the nature of the implements, because of the sharp implements, because of the saw blade, because of a motorized saw or whatever this performer was using. So, yeah, it's anyone who's done an amateur theater production, anyone who's ever been on stage knows what happens in terms of nerves. And all you have to do in a magic show is, you know, combine dangerous things, dangerous objects.
And choke on something.
With choking or nerves, yes.
Yeah.
And, of course, that's something you always have to keep in mind, is that, you know, everybody's nerves are turned up in the middle of a performance, and often that leads to bad results.
I was in Vegas some time ago, and Chris Angel walked right by me. I waved at him, hey, Chris. But he's a great illusionist, isn't he?
He's done a lot of work. He's done a lot of work on television. And he's had a big successful show in Las Vegas as well.
Yeah, he's doing well. Let's take some calls here, Jim. We'll go to Chuck in Bay City, Michigan. Welcome to the program. Hey, Chuck, go ahead.
Hello, George. I was wondering if your guest has ever thought about the possibility that Dracula was Judas Iscariot. It seems as if, though, most of the things that have been connected with Dracula's allergies are directly connected to the crucifixion, the 30 pieces of silver, the crown of thorns. Thorns are supposed to keep Dracula from approaching the stake through the heart made out of wood, because the cross was made out of wood. Mm-hmm. And there's lots of stories about the wandering Jew who was not allowed to go to heaven or hell because of something that he did to offend Christ. Mm-hmm. But I can't think of anybody that would do anything worse to offend Christ than
Judas
Iscariot, yeah, with the betrayal.
It's really, really fascinating. There's a lot of scholarly work about literary and religious symbolism combined in that book. And there's no question that Stoker drew very heavily on religious symbolism in that book. Clearly, the antidote to the vampire all through it is this kind of religiosity. And we see that, even though Stoker, his own background wasn't necessarily, Catholic, he uses those images from the Catholic Church. I think that's really interesting, you drawing the comparison to Judas. One of the things that I write about in the book is that in many ways you can look at Dracula as not necessarily a villain, which is quite strange because of how he's portrayed. But there's something in literature called a Byronic hero. A Byronic hero is was made popular by Lord Byron. But the notion of it is a man out of place, a man who is right in one place, but when the times change and when the situation changes, he's wrong. He's not in the right place. And that's the tragedy of the story. And you can see that completely in Dracula, which is someone who is kind of functioning well in his own world in Transylvania, but then longs to be somewhere else, wants to come to London, wants to be in a modern city. And when he does that, he has to really be chased back again. They have to chase him back to the old country and then kill him, because he ventured too far. He tried for too much. And it's very interesting because, of course, that's also the kind of Judas tragedy, is someone who was a follower and who was right at one time and then was out of place.
Was there much symbolism in Bram Stoker's books?
Yes. He loved to mix up myth and superstition in all of his books. Dracula is heavy with symbolism. And I think some of it is personal symbolism of these people he knew in his life. I think the crucifix, even the little gold crucifix that is used to repel a vampire, the crucifix was something, that little gold crucifix was something that Oscar Wilde gave to Bram Stoker's wife. And I think it was close to his mentality, that kind of religious symbol, from a friend of his who also went astray. So I think that there's a lot of symbols that are wrapped up inside that book, certainly a number of religious symbols.
Skype line is open, George 97313, first-time caller. Shirley's with us in Memphis, Tennessee. Hi, Shirley.
Oh, hello, George.
Good to have you with us.
I just wanted to try and put my thought together. I was listening earlier, and this was so interesting to me because he said that, Dracula was successful because it kept shifting and updating, and it kept, being able to be new movies that brought people in, right?
Yes.
Yep.
Okay. Well, then, a little after that, you were talking about, the movie sort of diverted from it, and you seemed a little disappointed that the movie sort of diverted a little bit from the book. And I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit on that. I mean, I felt that you were sensitized by that. And I'd like to know more about it. I've always been fascinated with Dracula movies.
Well, it's interesting. Dracula movies are very different than the book. Even Francis Ford Coppola did a version about 20 years ago where it was an effort to put the book in a film. And I'm not so sure that was even that was successful or true to the book. But the book is a real slice of late Victorian culture. You know, it's written in a very old style. And there are sections of the book, to be honest with you, that are kind of slow and stodgy. I think people that would read it today would be really surprised, again, at how many different things are in it, how it's told in a very different way. When it went to the West End, when it went on stage, it sort of became this thing where, people stood around sofas and talked, you know, or stood by bedsides and talked. It sort of became a drawing room mystery. And I think that when it went to Hollywood, we still see remnants of that in the Bela Lugosi movie. There's a lot of standing around in gowns and tuxedos and discussing what's happening. And that was really a remnant of the stage play, because that's what they had to do on stage in order to make this work. So Dracula has proven to be incredibly durable. I don't mean to be disappointed in the film. I think the film is a really remarkable artifact. I don't know that it's necessarily always a brilliant film, and it's not always a brilliant representation of what Bram Stoker wrote, but I do think it's a great cultural piece. You can see this Dracula legend moving through the era by the time it gets to 1931, and you can see it all right there on film. A little bit of Broadway, a little bit of Hollywood, a little bit of the Victorian novel, and it's all been mixed together. But I do think that the important aspect of it is that this character just keeps shifting. Even Bram Stoker might not have anticipated how durable that character is. You can put him in just about any form and he works. He becomes interesting to a new generation.
Did Dracula want to die deep down inside?
He certainly has, there's a slight pathetic quality to him, in which Mina, at the end of his, when she watches him die, sees the peace on his face. And we recognize that somewhere in this kind of horrible being, there's peace that's been brought to him, and that's somewhat the religious tone as well. Other versions of the story have capitalized on that and accentuated that as Dracula's become more and more human. Again, in the book, the great mystery is that we see so little of him. We're always projecting onto him these emotions, these senses. It's people talking about him. It's people wondering about him. But Stoker held all of that back from us. Stoker wouldn't actually give us good glimpses of Dracula. And I think it was other producers after that that had to fill in all those pieces.
Next up, we go to Jefferson City. That's in Missouri, east of the Rockies. Roger, go ahead.
Hey, George, Jim. Quick shout-out to my friend Scott, who loves listening to you guys every night.
There you go.
The question I have is, I was born in 55. I grew up on the old classic horror films with Christopher Lee as Dracula.
Yes.
You know, the Wolfman, Lon Chaney. Who do you think the greatest vampire Dracula was?
Well, you know, I'm glad you mentioned Christopher Lee, because, you know, there's another generation where that all started again. And Christopher Lee was the first Dracula where you really saw the animal in that character. You know, you really got that combination of wolf and man, that sort of inhuman being. And, of course, that was also the era when you could really start showing blood on film. And that's what Hammer films were famous for being gory, although I think by today's standards they really weren't. I'll tell you a really fascinating Dracula if you've never seen it, and of course now it's kind of easy to do on YouTube, is Nosferatu, which is the 1922 film.
Ugly guy.
An unbelievably, what do I want to say, reptilian, insect-like character.
He was played with like hamster teeth.
Yes, he has. He has incredibly sharp teeth and claws.
Yeah.
Not just long fingers, claws.
Yeah.
And he looks like a rat. The man looks like a rat.
He does. He does look like a rat. Even a rat looks better than he does.
Well put, George. He was played by an actor named Max Schreck. And it's a very strange, expressionistic German film. It's not called Dracula. It was called Nosferatu. And, in fact, Bram Stoker's widow worked very hard to prevent the film from being shown many places because it had not been licensed. It was taken from the story. It was basically stolen from the story out of copyright. And she prevented the film from being shown for many years. But there's something incredibly creepy about the silent version of this film that's set many years earlier than the novel originally took place, and it's set in Germany. And something about the way, the kind of herky-jerky motion of the film, the expressionistic German film, it's really a nightmare. And if you watch it, I promise you, you will see it again in your nightmares. It's something to behold.
Just dramatic. I mean, I remember the black and white movie of Nosferatu. I mean, he was just hideous.
Some of those films are just perfect because they were made when the technology was just right to tell that story. And I think in some way, silent film is just right for that. Yeah.
Okay. Next up, we go next to Calistoga, California. It's Michael's turn west of the Rockies. Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah. Hi.
Hey, Mike.
I just wanted to comment about in the original Stoker book. There's a character in it he's from Texas.
Uh-huh.
And he's never in any of the movies, but in the book he's the one that stabs Dracula when they catch up with him with a Bowie knife in the heart.
That's right.
And the Englishman cuts off his head with a Gurkha knife.
That's absolutely right. You've got that all.
Yeah.
Right. But somehow they don't put a stake.
Never shown in any. It never ends up in any of the movie versions. And I just thought that was interesting because he's never in it, and he's kind of a main character in the book.
I think the Francis Ford Coppola film, which was called Bram Stoker's Dracula, has an effort to put Quincy Morris in. That was the name of the character, Quincy Morris. Quincy Morris.
Oh, he is in that. I think he's in
the in that film that was done I think it was in the 70s or 80s. I don't have the year in front of me. Quincy Morris is a very interesting character, and it says a lot about Bram Stoker. I think modern audiences would be surprised to find a cowboy in the middle of Dracula, and that's exactly what he is.
Yeah,
he's a cowboy. At one point, he pulls out a revolver and fires at a bat. And everyone, of course, in stately old England is surprised at that. Bram Stoker was fascinated by America. He came to America several times with Henry Irving's company. He loved Americans. He loved America. He was a big fan of Abraham Lincoln. Of course, he never knew him, but he collected Lincoln artifacts, and he lectured on Lincoln back in London. And he was an enormous fan of Buffalo Bill. And there's every reason to believe that Quincy Morris is modeled in many ways on Buffalo Bill, on Bill Cody. Quincy Morris is a real gentleman. He talks with a Texas accent, and Stoker makes an effort to put American phrases in and American slang. And he's an upright gentleman, and he's one of the first men to offer transfusions when the women are in need of blood. And you're right; he's one of two people who dispatch Dracula. He does it with his Bowie knife. Strangely enough, no one puts a stake through Dracula's heart, even though we're told that that's what's going to happen. But he does put the knife through his heart, and supposedly that does the trick.
All right, stay with us, Jim. We're going to come back and take final phone calls with you right here on Coast to Coast AM. Jim's book again, Who Was Dracula? Bram Stoker's Trail of Blood. And his website, of course, is his name, which is linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. Let's come right back and take final calls with Jim. Next hour, we'll have open lines for you here on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, Beyond Belief is our television program, and you can look at it 10 days free to take advantage and look at all the great videos that go with it. Simply go to our website, Coast to Coast AM, up at the top, click Hosts, and then it'll say TV show. Open that up, and there you go, and you can fill out the information. And we really think you'll like it. Or you can go to GaiamTV.com/George. GaiamTV.com/George. Tell me what you think of my tie. And welcome back to Coast, Jim Steinmeier with us. We'll take your calls. Jim, what do you think is the most common misconception about Stoker's work or Dracula?
I think what people mix up constantly is the way that Hollywood's portrayed him and the way that Hollywood's portrayed that story. Only a little bit of that made it through from the novel all the way through to the story. I think what we've lost is, we've held on to the bits of Transylvania, but we've lost the kind of horrors of what happens in Transylvania. All of that's been pared down really because of budget reasons in the original script. So The novel is much more complicated and much more involving a story than that. And I think that in an effort to kind of commercialize it and simplify it, we've lost those aspects.
Who published it? You know,
it was published by Constable in Great Britain. It was a popular. It was published as a novel. It was a potboiler. You know, at the time, it got good reviews, not great reviews. People thought it was a good novel. They remarked on kind of how horrific it was, but it didn't necessarily stand out in its era. It was that was much later when it was popularized in other forms.
All right, back to the calls we go. Let us go to Minnesota. Daniel's there, first-time caller. Hey, Daniel, go ahead.
I'm just calling about the whole story of where vampires come from. Actually, it's people who used to make the Philosopher's Stone recipes from extracting the blood of just people, and people would have marks on their neck. So the whole myth of vampires, like, oh, people are coming in and sucking our blood. Well, there's actually people fermenting the blood and making a Philosopher's Stone, or otherwise known as Elixir of Life, mm-hmm. to make the gold edible to increase their lifespan. Everybody wants to live longer.
Interesting. And it's also interesting that, you know, what you're saying is that myth comes out of the kind of the myth of immortality, the desire for immortality as well. Yeah.
There's a book from the elite alchemist order, and it's also mentioned in the Nubian Bible.
Explain.
That's all I can say.
Okay. All right. Very good. Appreciate that. Next up, we go to James, Charleston, West Virginia, east of the Rockies. Hey, James, go ahead. You're on with Jim Steinmeier.
Yes, Mr. Steinmeier. Good morning. I do remember that there were two other motion pictures, I believe, that had the Quincy Morris character in it. Jess Franco's Dracula with Christopher Lee.
Oh, yes.
Between Germany. Oh, by the way, Jess died days ago, suffered a stroke. And I believe the Louis Jordan miniseries at the
beginning. Oh, yes, yes. The miniseries was kind of perfectly suited to this novel because it you know, all the kind of rambling adventures.
It was considered
that worked really well. Yeah.
Possibly before Coppola's, it was considered the best, most precise of the stories.
Louis Jordan also made a fantastic Dracula.
Oh, yes, he did. He was
Dracula was a nobleman, and you know, in all the descriptions of the novel, what we do get from the descriptions is this incredibly proper, almost kind of poetic speech that he has, and I think that you really see that in Louis Jordan.
Quite true.
Okay, thank you. Did Dracula truly live that long? How old was he, do you think?
Well, the story was, if we go by, you know, the history that Stoker, you know, borrowed from Wallachia in that area, is that he was, he was 400 years old at the time that the story was taking place. So yes, the story was is that he had gained immortality through being a vampire. We never hear how Dracula became a vampire. Presumably, it's with the same kind of curse of being infected by a vampire. But he always seems more powerful. He seems to be kind of the king of the vampires. The king. He seems to rule over others in that area. And so we never really have an understanding of why that is, why he's been singled out.
Prior to being Dracula, was he a good guy, or was he Vlad the Impaler?
Well, Stoker wouldn't have known the story of Vlad the Impaler and didn't know them. And the story he talks about Dracula, the story he gives him, the backstory, is that he's a very smart, effective ruler. So I think to answer your question, in the novel, he seems to be a good guy. He seems to be a powerful ruler and a good guy, but this has somehow happened to him. And in the course of it, he's become someone that's now infecting other people.
All right, let's go to John in Newark, New Jersey, on the wild card line. John, good morning. Go ahead.
Okay, good. Jim, are you there?
Yep. He is. He is.
Okay, let me just turn on the radio 1 second.
Okay, go over there. Yeah. Turn it down.
I read the book, and one very scary part where he opens the window, Dracula. And he goes out the window, and he sticks to the wall like a snake.
Yes.
remember that?
Like a lizard.
Like a lizard.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very scary part. In other words, you open up the window, and Dracula, he sticks to the wall, and he snakes like a snake. He sticks to the wall, and then he goes into another room.
He takes the form in the novel. He takes the form of a bat. He takes the form of a wolf. He takes the form of mist. He certainly is able to hypnotize people. And then, just as you said, one of the most horrific moments is when Jonathan Harker is locked in the castle, when he's a prisoner in the castle. He sticks his head out of the window, which is kind of all he can do.
Ooh.
And he looks up the tower, and he sees Dracula emerge from his window and scale head first down the wall.
With his face coming at him, right?
With his face coming at him. And
sticking to the wall, right, right.
Yeah, and now, that another, was so effective a moment that they tried to do it in the original production of Dracula in London in the 1920s. That was something that the producer was insisting on doing, but it was just too difficult and too costly to stage.
Right. And another thing, I read the book. He's killed. I kept reading the book, and in one sentence at the end of the book, it shows, you know, they put the stake in. It's like it builds up to a climax, and then all of a sudden, boom. You remember that?
Yes. There's a funny thing that happens in that book, which is that they have to end up chasing him back. Right around the time that they seem to have won, they realize that he's racing back to Transylvania. They also realize that they have to actually get rid of him, because if they don't, and again, this is the kind of plague, this is the sort of curse that's written into the story, that Mina, the leading lady, will turn into a vampire. And so they have to chase him back to Transylvania. And that becomes a big adventure at the end, because they chase him back by several routes to try and anticipate getting back there before he does. And the end comes, just as you say, it comes very, very quickly at the end of this big chase, and suddenly he's dispatched. If you read it carefully, it doesn't quite match the rules that Stoker laid out for how he had assessed to be destroyed. But there's no question it worked, of course, at the end.
And, of course, you would become a vampire if you got bitten by one, right?
You would become a vampire if you were bitten by one and died of one.
And died of one.
In other words, if your death was caused by, you know,
But then you come back.
And then you come back as a vampire. Stoker has a way, because this was a new rule that he was initiating in this book, and it's of course, it really changes the book completely when he writes this. It changes all the dynamics of the characters, and it's a very, very clever, dramatic piece of action. But Stoker is still experimenting with it, and he's vague about it. He describes it as that if you're under the spell of a vampire, if you happen to be under the spell of a vampire when you die, because there's a kind of influence that a vampire has over you while he's coming in the night and drinking your blood. And that's the way that Van Helsing expresses that rule.
Okay, back we go. Let's go to Pam in Norcross, Georgia, on the wild card line. Pamela, go ahead.
Hi, how are you guys?
Good,
tonight?
Pam. Thank you.
I just wanted to say I have a couple of comments and three questions that related to everything you guys talked about tonight.
Okay.
I think Vampire Diaries is better than Twilight. Frank Langella was one of the sexiest Draculas. And I was wondering if you had ever, Jim, read a series written by Brian Lumley called Necroscope.
Oh, I'm familiar with it. I haven't read it, but I am absolutely familiar with it, yes.
Yes, that's one of the first books that I ever read about vampires that used the term vampire.
Yes.
Also, did you ever work on any of the Earth, Wind, and Fire shows that Doug Henning did?
Oh, no, I didn't. You know what? That was a little before my time, and
okay.
I knew very well the people who worked with it. A number of besides Doug Henning, a number of really great magicians and consultants, John Gaughan, Glenn Priest, Brian Lumley, worked on that show, and they did amazing magic in those shows.
They did. I saw all of them. And
oh,
so
great.
I'm telling my age.
Yeah, okay.
And my other question was, have you ever heard of the serial killer H.H. Holmes?
Yes.
Okay, I know you guys mentioned Jack the Ripper. Do you think that he may have been the Ripper? I know that's been put out there that he might have been in London at the time that those murders occurred.
There is certainly, he's one of the suspects, and there are a number of suspects that track back to America, and I know that he was one of them, although I think the problem with Holmes is that, you know, his method of killing people was so different. But I think there's suspicion of whether that serial killer would have used different extremely different methods like that.
And they also,
I know that he's certainly suspected.
They also thought a member of the royal family might have been one,
well,
right?
There was all sorts of suspicion about, yes, there was either the royal surgeon or there was a kind of a wild theory about, I think it was
one of the princes or something.
Yeah. Clarence was involved in a scandal a few years before that, which was called the Cleveland Street Scandal, and I write about that in the book, in my book. So certainly the royal family drifted in and out of those scandals. I think that's a long stretch for that's been a stretch for the Jack the Ripper stories, but there were no lack of suspects in the Jack the Ripper story, but none of them actually ended up getting pinned with the crime.
Next up, Buffalo we go, east of the Rockies. Hey, Dan, go ahead.
Oh, hi, guys. You know, this is really great stuff.
Yes, it is. It's exciting. I love it.
And, you know, this is not the first time I've heard biographical stuff on Stoker, but I love it. I love it. And, you know, you mentioned the Louis Jourdan, which is kind of obscure now, that film. I managed to find it in a discount bin once, and I grabbed it. But the same year, there was a competing Dracula, and that was Frank Langella, which was a more romanticized take. And I was wondering if you were familiar with both, and you know, just wanted to bat that around for a minute or so.
I've seen both of them. Langella, there was a really wonderful, influential production of Dracula that came back to Broadway, and that was Frank Langella. That's why Frank Langella became Dracula. He basically did the Dean and Balderston play that made Bela Lugosi a star when it came back on Broadway in the 1970s. And that was a really amazing production. It had sets by Edward Gorey, and all the sets were black and white.
Wow.
All done as black and white sketches with little bits of red in each set, a red sofa or something on the bed that was red. And it was famous. It was famous for the look of it, and it was famous for kind of dusting off the old 1920s play and bringing it back. And it was really successful. When that was made into a film, that was basically the film you're talking about. That was the Frank Langella Dracula. Yeah. Based again on the
Broadway
show.
And you added to my collection. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. There you go. Let's go to Tom, Long Beach, California. Hi, Tom. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for having me. I wanted to mention something real quick. I was once a sports writer. We were covering the Lakers, and there was a guy that played for the Lakers named Vlade Divac. You probably remember him. He was a chain smoker, and one of these guys on the on press row coined him Vlad the Inhaler. Okay. I thought you might like that. But anyway, I wanted to mention something about the appeal of Dracula. I always thought there was a hidden message in there that everybody wants to live forever, and the draw, and you know, and the appeal of that, you know. People would say, I'd make that deal. I'd become a vampire if I could live forever, even if I couldn't go out at night and all that. But then as you watch, you see that all the horrible things he has to put up with. I think the hidden message might be, if I could just posit this, that maybe there are things worse than death. You know, that living forever maybe isn't all that it's cracked up to be. You know, I just wonder what your thought is on that.
No, I think that's a really, really good point. And I think that works beautifully with the literature. I think that there's a kind of hedonistic aspect to the, you know, wouldn't it be great to live forever and do whatever you wanted to do? And I'll tell you the story where we see that, and this ties right back to Bram Stoker, is the Faust story. That, you know, Faust makes a deal with the devil, and, you know, he achieves something out of that, and the devil achieves his soul. And the Faust story was put on stage by Henry Irving, and Bram Stoker was involved in the very elaborate production of Faust on the Lyceum stage. And Faust was done just right around the time that he started to write Dracula. So the character of the devil on stage, the deal with the devil, you know, making the deal for immortality and you know, bargaining with the devil, that's all part of Bram Stoker's mentality. I mean, he lived that production of Faust for many months just before Dracula started. So I think all of that, I think all those classical allusions in that sense is exactly right. And I think that when we see Dracula, when we feel sorry for Dracula, when Mina finally comes to feel sorry for him at the end of the book, we understand that he's kind of found peace in a way that maybe he didn't even expect it.
Would Bram Stoker have approved of today's Dracula?
It, It's a really good question. He wrote a kind of astonishing essay late in his career about censorship and about lewd material. Very critical of books that offered kind of lascivious messages. And I have to tell you, reading this essay is a jaw-dropping experience because Dracula, his own book, is so filled with sexual imagery that it's quite astonishing that it got past the Victorians when he wrote it. So I think that Stoker, on a certain level, even though he was able to embed all these messages in the book, I think on a certain level he was a prude. I'm not so sure he would have approved of all of the incarnations of Dracula, but I think he would have been enormously proud to have this character survive and to have so much attention given to it that important producers, important writers, you know, are reinventing it and working with it. Bram Stoker was a man of the theater. He was involved in all the productions of Henry Irving. He knew exactly what it was like to rewrite a play. He knew that it was necessary. He knew that every actor brought something different to the role. He wouldn't have been shy about that at all. He would have understood all of that. And so I think he would have admired Lugosi. He would have admired Langella. He would have admired anybody that brought something new to the role. That was really his job.
Well, there's no doubt about that. Jim, about a minute or so left. Let's see if we can squeeze one more call in here. It's Wilden in Cascadia, Oregon. Real fast. Go ahead.
Hey, thanks very much for taking my call. Sure. Great show tonight. I had a comment that I'd like to hear discussed, if you can, about the hypersexualization of youth in the modern vampire story and the seemingly patriarchal dominant male and the weak slave female.
Okay, that's good points. 30 seconds, Jimmy.
There's always been a feeling that Dracula is either a book about the modern woman or Dracula's a book that's misogynistic, that's critical of women. I will say this about the sexuality in the book. Vampire story is always an opportunity for people to talk about sex who aren't supposed to talk about sex. You know, there's a kind of hyper lust, there's a kind of forbidden knowledge going on inside this book. To the Victorians, it was a chance to address these things without actually talking about sex, and it's not surprising today that that's what teenagers get to do when they talk about vampires. You get to walk right up to the line, but you're not doing it.
Jim, thank you again so much. Jim Steinmeier, the name of his book, of course, Who Was Dracula? I shall be back in a moment with Open Lines on Coast to Coast AM.